You are listening to KBOO Portland. I am your host, Lisa Loving. Good morning. We're keeping it real. And we have the coolest guest. I say that every week, don't we? We don't have loser guests on the show. I'm not sure who those people are. But our guest today is Jordan Fink, who wants to get people to plant 1 million chestnut trees in temperate areas around the world. He and his starting with a whole bunch in Portland, Multnomah County, Jordan and his organization Build Soil are building community-based climate resiliency agriculture projects. Their website, if you want to jump ahead, is buildsoil.net, and they're doing a fall tree giveaway later in a few weeks. Jordan, thanks for being here.
I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. This is live radio, in case you wondered. Jordan, you're my favorite kind of guest. When I started reading about your work with the chestnut trees, all of a sudden, I just wanted to drink the ocean. I wanted to drink the ocean. I wanted to know everything about it right now.
Let's get into it.
And there's a lot to learn about the organizing and the science. To do those both at the same time is the secret sauce. So, Jordan, also, you told me something this week that blew my mind. Portland's one of the few cities that has actively legalized chestnut planting. So how did you come to this big idea, and why is the organization called Build Soil? First, how did you come to the big idea?
The big idea being the chestnuts. So I have for the last several years been teaching through social media and online about ecological responses to climate change. You know, people get so caught up in the fear or the denial or the nihilism around climate change. And it's frustrating to see people not realize that there's things that they could be taking on an individual, but then ultimately on collective and larger scales together, and giving people examples. So I had a lot of people reaching out, what should I plant? What should I do? And rather than giving them a complex answer, a lot of them made sense to plant chestnut trees. They have a lot of benefits that first of all, as opposed to other nuts, chestnuts, their chemistry is more like a grain. So they're appropriate for pasta, pizza, bread, desserts, and there's places all over the world and communities throughout history that have drawn on chestnuts. And the other benefit is people always think, well, I can't plant enough corn to feed the people of Portland. I can't, you know, there isn't enough ground space. Well, chestnuts produce all that food overhead in the canopy and only have the trunk on the ground level. So they're actually compatible with urban spaces in a way that corn, wheat, barley, those types of things could never. So it's a good first planting.
It's an ancient thing.
Like
societies throughout human mm-hmm. history have literally sat down, smoked a cigar, that part might be an exaggeration, and said, we need to do something to make ourselves more sustainable. Let's plant a bunch of chestnut trees. Like, that's true, yeah, isn't it?
One of the earliest examples is there was a patch of chestnut trees that made itself from the global north down to Anatolia. And the Hittites began by planting chestnut trees. They expanded their empire by taking care of areas that were rocky, hilly, and putting trees in the ground. And they built a vital society off of the food value of those trees.
Where is the Hittites? Where is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Anatolia, modern-day Turkey.
Turkey, that's what I was going to say.
That's right. And then their successes spread to Rome and Greece and became part of sacred groves all throughout Europe. You see chestnuts wherever you see the goddess Nemea or the goddess Nemi or Danu or Diana. These chestnuts have always been part of headwaters and sacred places, and they've also been part of food culture.
Yeah, 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 because it's not just a nut. You can eat all kinds of, you can eat it so many different ways.
That's right.
Why is the organization called Build Soil?
So when we were thinking about our ultimate mandate, our ultimate communication, we realized that soil is really a good measure of the successes of a society. We know that most empires collapse after a couple hundred years, and it's ultimately because they degrade the basis that they're formed on.
The Roman Empire, they would sow the fields with salt to really defeat a country.
And you can just overexploit it. Our agricultural models grow a big population, a big society, and then they wipe themselves out. Now, if you have water in place, if you have good landscape design in place, if you have well-designed cities and communities in place, and if you have equity so that people aren't overexploiting resources and there can be some possibility of sustainable exchange, then soil gets built. And so it's the last result of having everything else in line. And so Build Soil can be a mandate that includes organizing with your community, making sure that there's equity, making sure that we're involved in justice, making sure that we're involved in the care of the landscape. It can be a small project and it can be a giant project.
I love this kind of conversation. You're just turning lights on all over the inside of my head. So in my head, a lot of the times there's this argument by these two angry entities, and one is liberal and the other is radical. And when I was in college, I learned that liberals believe that you can reform things, and radicals don't believe that. Radicals believe you either have to tear it down and rebuild it, or you have to rebuild it after it's collapsed. And you're saying build soil. You're not saying fix soil or repair soil. That's radical, man.
Yeah.
That's radical. I almost just used a curse word. That's how radical.
Yeah. So the thing to recognize is that we still have the subsoils of the planet. Topsoil is a mixture of organic life that's grown into the powder and clay and silt of subsoil. And it can be inoculated the way that you can put yeast into dough. But it takes time, it takes effort, and it takes a good relationship with water and compaction. And that's really important. So we do a lot of things that inhibit and change our capacity to build soil, to actually keep adding more. And one example is we've turned the grasslands of the world, which are amazing drivers of soil building, we've turned them into extractive agriculture in a way that we now treat soils as if they are a leaky hydroponic system. We just add all these nutrients, 80% of them flow into the groundwater, eventually ending up in the Gulf of Mexico and or other places, and they ultimately do a lot of harm. And, you know, in a lot of ways, this is the result of the world wars, where we built this giant machinery and this giant oil apparatus, and we used defoliants and we used all this huge equipment, and then we aimed it back at our landscapes after the wars and on the colonial processes.
I'm thinking of the Umatilla arms bunkers that were out there in Eastern Oregon all those years.
So we went to war with the soil after World War II. And that, you know, and at the same time, the Haber process, which was originally developed in order to build weaponry by the Germans, to build gunpowder, that got aimed back at our soils as nitrogen fertilizers. And now we have a nitrogen overload.
Because we had all that stuff, and then terrorists use it to blow up the Oklahoma building.
That's right.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving. This is Keeping It Real. We're here every Thursday morning at 8. And our guest is Jordan Fink with Build Soil. He's talking, we're leading up to this big idea of chestnuts, planting chestnut trees. So
people started asking me all these questions about chestnuts and about how to plant them.
What about chestnuts,
Jordan? I just started a what-if project. See, working online, I have a Twitter account at Build Soil. And I interact with a lot of younger people. So I'm 42. I grew up in the 90s with activist culture in the 90s in Portland. And I see a lot of people of the younger generation who are, they have drive, they have intelligence, but their tools are different. They have the tools of marketing. That's all they have. They have Instagram and Facebook and, well, they don't even have that, and TikTok and those things. And those tools are ultimately extractive for the purposes of data.
And they're actually growing the people and then harvesting
the people. And it's a security risk for organizers, too. And so one of the things I started talking about was, you don't know how to do a small group meeting in consensus. That's things I learned from old boomers in backyards in the 90s. So how do you do consensus? Well, you can't do it abstractly. You need a project. Okay, what if you could plant 20 trees in a 4x4 bed in your backyard and get your friends together and figure out, well, how do we keep these watered? Who's gonna be there when? And then where do we want them to go? Are there community organizations? Are there people in food need? Where do we plant them? Oh, there's legal barriers, for example, in some communities for the planting of chestnuts, just simply because they're messy trees, supposedly, even though they're less messy than horse chestnuts because people actually pick the nuts. And learning how to legalize a process or is more of a liberal reform side, or the other side of it is just learning how to trust each other is something that takes actual experiences. And so let's start with the Chestnut Project. And if honestly, any organization can think of their effort as human hours, right? You look at a protest, you look at a nonprofit, it takes time, and that takes food. To fuel. Two chestnut trees can, when they're in ideal conditions, produce, after about 20 years, as they're growing bigger and producing more each year, they can produce all of the grain equivalent nutrition that a person needs a year.
In 20 years. But see, the other thing about people, are you listening right now? Sit down. This thing about the chestnut trees, talk about how they are, how quickly they grow and how they can be used to build things.
That's right. So they start pollinating about year three. And for the trees we're growing, that's already, 1 or 2 years only after we hand them out. They pollinate about year three. If they reach each other, if they're able to mate, they will start producing nuts. It's a few at first, but within a few years, you start having these spiky balls on the trees, and the nuts come in the October, and there's food. And it can you can also then at that point test and say, do I like this chestnut? And you know, if it's one that you don't like the flavor of, then you have options of changing your strategy. But if you do like it, within 10 years, you should be starting to think about harvest, because you know, the commercial operations that do chestnut, they plan on the first 10 years being the grace period, and then 10-year production is when they begin. So something else I wanted to share was, as I started giving this like you know, this thought experiment, we started showing people how to do it. And so we planted 12,000 nuts in my tiny Portland backyard with a bunch of volunteers, really about a couple of weeks before the pandemic was announced. And so I was left
timing is everything.
You know, I was left with two volunteers wearing masks, waving at each other across the yard.
Because you wanted to create seedlings.
That's right. And so we got them out over the next couple of years, mostly through organizations like the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, which are left-leaning churches and mosques and temples and Buddhist monasteries. And they were amazing, showing up in the morning to grab trees from me. And also working with, we gave the majority of our trees to a nonprofit in Washington State on the Skokomish Reservation. No, sorry, the Snohomish Reservation, called People of the Confluence. And they distributed them to Native communities in Western Washington. I was a little surprised at first, but I learned that a lot of Native communities see them as compatible with their food cultures around acorns. They're similar trees. They have similar life cycles. Mm-hmm. And actually, Native people have been some of the most like serious people in terms of taking care of these trees and moving them out. And that's been exciting.
Where my mother lives in the San Joaquin Valley of California, I just got to visit her. A lot of places you go, people will say, this place is the breadbasket of the whatever. In the San Joaquin Valley, everybody says it's the breadbasket of America. And there's probably other breadbaskets. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Nebraska would be a little offended if they heard California bragging like that. But where my mom lives, you'll see entire orchards of nuts, mostly nuts. It's going to be almonds or those really hard mm-hmm. ones that I never eat that my dad loved, pistachios. And I mean, one day you'll be driving down the street or walking down the sidewalk and the whole thing has been bulldozed. Because, right. I mean, I don't know why I feel like a nut tree is more weighty than a tomato shrub. All the tomato semis are going back and forth where my mom lives now, too. Like, you can see all the crops. And there's a lot of give and take when it comes to organized agriculture, right?
That's right.
But talk a little bit about why, about chestnuts specifically. We know that there was a major mega chestnut blight that started 100 years ago. It eliminated something like
1915 was when that happened.
It eliminated something like 25% of all the chestnuts in the Appalachian chain, which is on the other side.
Well, let me clarify that, because when the blight,
you talk about that, like chestnuts themselves have been through something.
So just for global perspective, there are several species of chestnuts that are actually considered subspecies of each other. Their relatedness is very close. They're not that different from each other. What is different is that they all were one population about 25 million years ago in the Arctic, when the Arctic was warm. All of our forests in the temperate regions were one forest. And you can attribute a lot of the differences between ecosystems due to the attrition, the loss of trees as they move south towards the equators. So we had a population of chestnuts that showed up in New England and Appalachia, down into Georgia. There's a few other subspecies that are around in that region, including the Ozark chinkapin, which is a tiny little nut. Mm-hmm. And there's a European chestnut that started, it's kind of misnamed, it started in Anatolia and then was spread throughout Europe. And there's the Chinese chestnut, which is the most biodiverse of all of the chestnuts. It contains all of the traits and qualities that other chestnuts have, including the American chestnut. It has all the colors and shapes and sizes. And then there's a population of chestnuts in Japan and Korea that have the unique distinction of being the most fully blight resistant of all of the chestnut trees in the world. They do not get the blight in the same way as some of the other trees. So in the Americas, it's often talked about that as if these chestnuts were a quote unquote natural or wild phenomenon, but no, we see the genetic diversity of the American chestnut is actually fairly low. And that's a good sign that native populations were 100% responsible for the range of the American chestnut. And before the blight hit, there were 4 billion American chestnuts. They're a small nut. They're not as good for food value. They grow huge. They're great timber trees. You don't get a lot out of them, honestly, when you process them. But when they were hit with the blight, it was it's actually unclear how much the blight affected them.
Talk about the blight. What was the blight?
The blight is a fungal infection. And what it does is when the tree is a certain size, it takes over its vascular system and strangles it out. Smaller trees can die back and be coppiced and regrow, but then they get stuck in this kind of perpetual youth in the understory as other trees encroach. But the real crisis here was that the United States was already ready to eliminate the American chestnut. It was viewed as sort of a poor person's food, very like unappealing, and there was a lot of board feet of timber that they imagined coming from these beautiful chestnut trees. And when the blight hit, it was used as an excuse, and they cut trees preemptively. So most of any opportunities for genetic diversity that could have withstand the blight eliminated just through the sheer policy of removing chestnuts from the ground. And now there's almost no biodiversity in the American chestnut population, and it's being used as a symbol of biotech achievement. And there's a lot of issues right now with cloning and genetic engineering injecting into the wild population.
We should have a whole show just about that.
Another
because
issue.
That will hijack our entire conversation. Because we're here today to encourage people to take a stand, to organize and take an actual action go ahead.
So here in the Pacific Northwest, that's actually not the ideal tree for us. We have a Mediterranean climate. Our trees in the Northwest are best if they are European and Japanese crosses. They get the nice flavor of the European tree and the ability to live in Mediterranean climates. Because in Europe, they'll live in Turkey, they'll live in North Syria. There's chestnuts in Egypt, and there's also chestnuts in Scandinavia. So they have this wide range. But you were talking about California and agriculture. You know, there was a study a few years ago that looked at all of these different climate models, and the Portland metro area is slated by the year 2050, 2060, to have a climate similar to Sacramento. And if you think about...
No, I moved from there. I'm not going back there. No, Sacramento over here.
But here's the thing. Some of the largest chestnut trees on the West Coast are in Nevada City, Yuba, that area. And so chestnuts could be planted now, get established, and still be really successful. I wanted to also tell you another story about chestnuts. So as I was sort of exploring and putting out the idea, I started noticing a lot of young Italian Americans being like, awesome, we love chestnuts, we still get them, we still plant them. And I sort of took it as food culture, food waste. I mean, people love these trees, and every October the hills in Italy are full of castagna festas, all of these beautiful chestnut festivals. People love these trees. And so I was, you know, I understood on that level. And then one day a young woman came to me and she said, no, you don't understand at all. My grandparents were partisans fighting fascism in the hills, and they lived in the chestnut trees. They lived off of the chestnut forest. And as I started hearing this, I heard more and more stories that grandparents telling their children, you have to plant chestnuts because the fascists will come back.
Because
and
they were anti-fascist. Yeah. Yeah.
So the culture of chestnut trees, you go and you look at maps, chestnuts are often eliminated throughout Europe, as Europe has been, especially the Mediterranean regions in France and Italy, they've been urbanizing, and the chestnuts have been abandoned. But in these communities that had a history of anti-fascist activities, the chestnuts are still strong. And another good example is Corsica, where they chose in the 1700s, they were forced by French policy, colonial policy, to plant 4 chestnut trees per population, with the idea totally misguided that the French thought this would lead to a breakdown of the culture in Corsica.
Is that Napoleon thinking? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, Napoleon was Corsican, actually.
I know, yeah.
But so when Corsica was traded off to France, they were given this sort of like, oh, well, let's give them lazy food so that they don't rebel. Well, it was the opposite. Corsicans have maintained strong radical populations, radical movements in the 90s. And I've talked with some of those folks, and they've been like, yeah, it's because there's, you know, thousands and thousands of trees. We can live years without having to plant if we have to. So these trees, they offer resilience. They often offer a buffer. And obviously, it's one solution. It's one thing, but it's a good starting place.
If you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving. We are keeping it real here at KBOO Community Radio. Our guest today is Jordan Fink of Build Soil, and we're talking about this movement to plant sustainable chestnut trees. I shift the frame a little bit. What are all the things that Build Soil does? You've been teaching science to everyday people. Talk about all the things that you've been doing the past few years.
Well, part of it's about keeping an organization alive during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We were really lucky very early on because of the nice window of Twitter in 2019. We very quickly, I started teaching about permaculture, landscape design, not to the population of people often who are already knowledgeable about that stuff, but mostly to these young activists who are working in climate issues and are the level of anxiety is tremendous. They don't see any hope. So I started talking about, well, here's how an ecosystem functions. Here's how a society and an ecosystem relate to each other. Here are ways of modifying water. Here's ways of thinking about solutions. Here's other examples of projects in the world. So we started just teaching, and we quickly got to about 17,000 followers on Twitter. And in those golden days, I could do a single tweet, I could teach people a little lesson, and it would be seen by a couple thousand. And we started just receiving tips. People just started donating, and that was easy. So that's how we started planting all these trees. We started just taking the donations and putting them right into soil, right into trees. And so now we're sort of trying to figure out, now that those social media tools are less effective than they used to be. I know that they've been like fully colonized, right? So one thing we're doing is trying to build a collaborative atlas so that people can identify trees, plant trees, register trees, and begin to also make observations for scientific purposes. So we're building a community science process. Maybe it'll expand to things beyond chestnuts right now, but I like working with a case study and keeping to it. So we have a global data set of 300,000 chestnuts globally, and they have not been confirmed. They might be horse chestnuts. They may be misidentified. They might be missing. So we're getting people to go and visit the three chestnuts that are in, you know, in Stockholm and see how they're doing. Do they taste good? And because of diseases, all trees have diseases. Oak trees have diseases, and there's a number of them. We also want to make sure that every possible tree that's planted somewhere in a geographic region has the opportunity to be pollinated and the opportunity to provide nuts to the pool of chestnuts so that there's rich genetic options as the climate changes and those types of things.
And just to follow up really quickly on that, because this is a nerdly point too, you have to have a diversity of different kinds of chestnuts.
That's
like
right.
They can't, you have to have two, explain that part.
Well, you need to have a couple chestnuts. They can't be, so when you hear the word cultivar, what that's referring to are grafts. And that's a tradition that really began with fruit trees. And they find a chestnut they like, and they graft it to a base, and all the trees are basically clones of each other. And it's a way to get a reliable crop if you're doing big scale production. But at the same time, it doesn't allow us to take two trees, two nuts from the ground, plant them, and assume that they're going to produce something. We need to have something more like grexes in organic farming or complex genetics. And that's just simply, we need to have as many different kinds of trees growing together and sharing their genetics so that when weird cold snaps come through, when new diseases come through, when the climate changes, we have the option so that the trees that survive are the ones that we continue to plant. So you got to start with a lot of tools and a lot of options before you let the environment narrow down.
There's like 100 questions in my head. They're like just trying to, they're stuck in the door of my mind. When I was young, so long ago, no, just kidding. When I was young, I used to have this wonderful friend, and he was the permaculture guy. And he did you know him? He was about 6'3" and he had red hair. No, but his favorite thing was to walk through the city of Portland with seeds in his pockets, and he would just throw them on the ground, and he would visit those spots all year. And for him, permaculture was just throwing seeds on the ground to see if they would grow and to see if people would let them grow. But can you explain what is permaculture? Why is it important?
So permaculture, it's funny, I don't use the term as much as I used to. And part of that has to do with what's happened in America with permaculture. Permaculture was originally conceived by, was coined by this guy, Bill Mollison, who was a sociology and ecology teacher in Tasmania, and he worked closely with Aboriginal peoples. And he started noticing, as he was involved in consultations, that the international aid system was failing people, that they were imposing ideas from the global north, that they were ultimately preparing the global south for extraction. And he saw that traditional knowledge was essential and needed to be supported and centered. So he derived the permaculture curriculum as a fast-track way to support indigenous communities in the recovery of their landscapes as quickly as possible and in the centering of their own indigenous knowledge. He was disappointed, though. His curriculum, when it spread to America, when it spread to Europe, he didn't like the way it had become boutique gardening. It had become a form of colonizer behavior, and was often white, upper middle class in the way of that. So in the more recent years, permaculture has been taken up by libertarian types and folks that are involved in, you know, do-it-yourself kind of behavior. And that has become a little bit, it's hard when you look online for permaculture information. It gets aligned with a lot of stuff that isn't very helpful. But the curriculum itself, here's what I want to say about permaculture. Permaculture is permanent agriculture, or permanent culture. And it is not a prescription. It is the study of how human beings have been permanent in different locations around the world throughout history. And the curriculum of permaculture, it's a curriculum, teaches many of the different ways that communities, and it cites those communities and gives them credit for the knowledge systems that they hold. And it says traditional ecological knowledge can be understood as the fundamentally important basis for human land use. And we do not have to rely on an extractive agriculture for our societies and for our civilizations.
Progress is an ancient forest.
And what that means is if somebody says, oh, is this a permaculture garden? No, it's not. It may be a garden informed by somebody who went through a curriculum. It might be your grandma's garden who just she knew how to do that. It might have been done through observation. It might be a traditional system by an indigenous community. Permaculture should not take credit for any of that. It's simply an education system, just the same way that hydrologists don't take credit for the water systems of the world.
Interesting. That is so interesting. My grandmother had a rose garden, and she lived down there in Merced, so also in the San Joaquin Valley. And the whole thing was planted by my grandfather, who by all accounts was a really mean person. But he created the entire rose garden with rose slips that mm-hmm. he cut with a pocket knife from the municipal garden. Mm-hmm. And it took me years to understand what my parents were telling me about that. Like, no, these roses are different. They're not like from the rose store. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. They're not grafted. And that's kind of what you're getting at. But that was not permaculture either. That was him using the tools of permaculture before my grandmother threw him out. She threw him out. The guy cheated all the time. I mean, I know what I'm talking about. We're talking about chestnut trees. Anyway, I just want to close this loop. So as we shouldn't even be going around bragging and walking like Mick Jagger and talking about our gardens, really, probably. We should probably be doing more to think about, bigger systems. This is something that I wanted to ask you about. Pundits in the media describe climate change as something that suddenly happens or is looming, but it's been here for years. And your work involves, in a way, like the time frame of destruction versus I don't even know what. So I want to ask you, and this is a big, complicated question, but what can we hope for at this point with climate change? How should we be looking at it? What should we be reaching for?
Yeah, so climate change is a couple different things. I want everyone to start thinking a little bit about the complexity of nature and human systems as actually a bunch of layers. Fundamentally, everything is set by the climate. It sets the temperature, it sets how much water there's going to be, it sets the ranges and the pattern of things throughout the year. And as it changes, all of the other pieces have to move. The next piece is the shape of land. Landform is shaped by the patterns and duration of water over time. You'll notice if you look at landscapes here in the Pacific Northwest, you'll see sometimes these very high terraces. And that's because in other epochs, other climate regimes, those were where the floodplains were forming. As climate changes, the landscape processes change. If you can understand landscape, that controls water. And that controls where water flows, where water drains. If you can understand water, you understand roads and circulation and access. If you understand those things, you can understand where it's appropriate for people or settlements to be. And that helps you understand where vegetation, ultimately, and soil can be. These systems are on top of each other. You can imagine there is the environment, and out of that sets all of the rules for the society, which sets all of the rules and creates information systems and control systems. And the problem is, because our world is so flashy, we're surrounded by information, we often think that changes to the information system are sufficient in order to change the culture and the landscape. What I would suggest is an army marches on its stomach. A community responds to its food and resource needs. If we can start shifting the ways that solar energy and carbon are channeled through our bodies, we have the ability to take a new perspective. And chestnuts reorganize people's lives. I spent all of October getting up way early before the squirrels, and it's just me and a bunch of Chinese aunties collecting chestnuts and talking about recipes. And then I go home and I process the nuts. I freeze some. I eat some right away. I share some with my volunteers and my neighbors and find the best ones for planting. that process in October consumes my life. I'm a very chestnut focused person in October. And then there's a nice long winter. And in the spring, we plant them. And then we do a little bit of watering and care throughout the year. Our lives are shaped by them. But now food comes out. I wake up in the mornings and I take my chestnut flour and I make pancakes with it. And it's delicious. You know, I think understanding these things, I see people working more and more on like, well, we need better computer systems, we need better information systems, we need better branding. And you're talking about the, what hope do we have? Well, I have hope because we haven't tried all the things that we have options are. We aren't doing a lot of the things that we could be doing. So, you know, it's easy to make up a story about inevitability. Sometimes I notice that there's a lot of messaging about the inevitability of nothing being able to happen because actually, they don't want us to do anything. They don't want us to change anything. Some people have the inevitability story around it. Well, it'll have to include my particular approach, which usually is a lot of money, a lot of biotech, a lot of technology. Those inevitabilities draw us into something that, you know, but at the same time, let's look at our city. We have a problem. Every winter, we have a ton of rain, and it's a problem. It gets into our streets, and it creates flooding, and it, you know, fills our sewers. And then in the summer, we're dry and we have nothing and we're dealing with a drought. Our cities are designed to quickly move water off of land. Our farms are designed to quickly move water off of land, which means colonially, we have to then find a water source to provide drinking water and irrigation. There are ways of designing our cities and landscapes so that they are not machines for desertification. We actually design our landscapes for desertification. Thinking about almost a 180 degree shift of storing water, holding water, taking care of ponds, distributing that, putting in proper vegetation, designing our streets so that they actually move water into basins so that we can water later. These things are totally possible, and they've been done by cultures and civilizations all over the world throughout history, and we act like they're not even possible.
Like we're not even asking the right questions. And that is a question that I'm going to have for you a little later. Last time I talked with someone like this, it was Mark Lakeman.
Oh, yeah.
You had a part of the Village Building Convergence. Yeah. Talk about your role in that.
So before City Repair was... Mark Lakeman is the longest running organizer in City Repair. He was one of the people who initiated it. And I happened to be 17 years old, walking down the street. I was listening to KBOO, and I found out that there was an event that they had just gotten a temporary permit on one of their projects because they'd done this illegal takeover of the street. And
to paint an intersection.
Mm-hmm. And one of the volunteers was here at KBOO saying, come on down. We just got approved temporarily. Vera Katz, let us have a year of this. And we went down, and it was this beautiful piazza had been painted in the streets, and they were having a community festival and they were feeding each other. And I was like, this looks like the world I want. And so I immediately got involved. And man, the culture in Portland in the 90s, it's easy to get nostalgic. We were standing on the shoulders of the baby boomers who had organized in Portland in the 70s and 60s. And in the 90s, there was this incredible community, cheap rent.
I was just going to say that really the ability to live here was the key.
Yeah, you could paint a garage and cover your rent for the, you know.
Yeah.
And I got to meet the generation of people just a little older than me. And every week we start driving around with a truck in a cafe and they do amazing work. We start painting in the street. We started doing community organizing and that kind of stuff. I learned a lot in City Repair, and I was a co-director of the organization for about 9 years before I moved on to other things.
Mark Lakeman, once when I first met him, and it must have been in the year 1998, it had to have been in that year, yeah, he explained to me why all cities are laid out the way, not all cities, Portland, Oregon, why Portland, Oregon was laid out the way it was. Yeah. And he's talking about the Roman army. He's talking about when the soldiers come marching, they have everybody already corralled because of the way the roads are set up. And when we watched the civil unrest in 2020, all I could think about was how right Mark Lakeman was, that the entire downtown was set. People think it's set up to go to the shopping mall or something, but it was actually set up to control the population.
We still use the term, like when we're laying out a grid for urban planning, it's still called centuriation.
I have to do a breathing exercise now.
But here's the thing: is almost all of the communities that were laid out in those kinds of grid patterns
rebuild.
They had to rebuild because honestly, once they lost some of the capacity that they had as part of the Roman Empire, they had to actually deal with flooding and water issues, and their sewer systems started failing. There were some that were in happened to be in good locations, but most of them had to be rebuilt. And so they went right next door and they started building roads that could actually drain. One example is Tuscany. When they formed little city states against each other and were trying to compete, Siena moved into the hills and they took over at the top of a hillside. And they built their roads to extract and move water into ponds up high on the land. Then they took those ponds and they capped them and turned them into the public squares that make Siena. You can visit the underground waterways of Siena, and the city itself, posed on a hill, is able to collect water that is used for irrigation for the fields underneath. Those Tuscan hill towns are almost exactly the kind of landscape that we could be doing here in the Portland area.
But no, we need more condos. We need more condo units, okay?
And here's the funny thing. You know, there was the effort a few years ago to redevelop and build a city in Damascus, Oregon, and which failed because of reasons, Tea Party and a bunch of other stuff. And the plan that they ultimately came up with was beautiful, but what they focused on was they moved all of the urban development into the floodplains or the terraces and lowlands, all the soil landscapes, all the places that are farmland. And they kept the gravelly hillsides, you know, they made them like Mount Tabor or something like that. They made the peaks the forested areas, and they made the soils the urban areas. And I'm looking at that and thinking, reverse it. Let's have hill towns, and then let's keep our valleys and our lowlands for ecology and soil and water.
Again, going back to the Central Valley in California, where there's an entire lake, an ancient lake is gathering itself together again, and the landowners, I'm just going to say the rich farmer that controls almost all the land in that area, he's the one who has to lump it, I guess, while it's filled with water. I want to follow up on what you just said, because when I've been trying to figure out how to ask this question, and you said they don't want us and what strikes me is, like, we've been talking about a lot of the Roman army, man. I'm the queen of watching movies about the Roman army. Don't even get me started. I love Boudica. We probably might not have liked her if we had to sit next to her on a bus, but I'm saying, though, who is they? Like,
question.
In my head, I'm thinking, there's a lot of they, but somehow the mayor of the city looms large. But I'm not sure that the mayor of the city really controls development. Even if the mayor of the city actually had a beautiful vision, if it could happen anywhere, it could happen in Portland, honestly. But there's who controls it, but then there's also who do we agitate to try to bring a different vision to the table?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. Who's they? Well, I think when I mean they, I mean, look, in the whole world, every process tries to maintain itself.
Yeah.
You try to maintain your life. You try to make sure that you can eat. You try to help your children. And the global empire has the same mandate. It is trying to maintain its own structures, its own ways of doing things. You know, there is a adage in systems ecology that systems that sustain themselves are those that use the energy they collect partially for their own maintenance and partially for the capture of more energy. And that's, you know, trees grow bigger and bigger and grow bigger leaves. Empires do that too. And they, you know, you were talking earlier about the juxtaposition, which I think is a valid one, of liberalism versus activism or radicalism.
Just trying to figure out what these ideas even mean.
And I think something to bring up is that, you know, when I'm trying to diagnose if something's liberal, it isn't so much whether it's reform or not. It's whether or not it views that the fundamental unit of human activity should be in markets. Right. And, you know, you look at places that did liberalism, soft liberalism, kind liberalism, usually good economic periods, you know, times when they felt like it benefited them to have a strong middle class or working class. And you have other places like Pinochet, where he applied economic liberalism in a completely different tactic. And ultimately, it's the same economic policies. They're just different levels of intensivity. So that ability to, like, consume everything and see everything as solvable through invisible hand of exchange and ultimately the extraction and benefit of an investment class.
Solvable from an invisible hand. I hear you, man. Yeah.
So it is that, like, perpetuation of an investment class, that in perpetuation of a system that is benefiting through the extraction and the design of extraction. This, I think, is in a lot of ways where there was this ridiculous article in, I think, the Washington Post, where they were talking about during the Black Lives Matter marches, how white anarchists were in the way of the support of the Black community in Portland. And I have a number of friends in the community who were like, that's not true. Like, they were the ones who were standing with us. And we were thinking about it, and we're like, oh, the real problem here is that the liberal view is that benefit of people, their version of racial justice isn't justice, it's market access.
Somebody somewhere has to make a paycheck.
And so their view of benefiting society is that how do we get people incorporated into the workplace, incorporated into the consumption loop? And so anything that actually supports communities without bringing them into the market is viewed as counter to their view. And a lot of people have inherited this. There's a lot of folks who think, well, you know, if self-sufficiency is not actually our goal, it's not, we don't want people to become self-sufficient. We don't want to support communities of color. We don't want to support them in that way. We want to melt them all together so that they can become good consumers. I don't think that that's appropriate in a lot of ways. I don't think that it's appropriate as a white organizer to be stepping into any community of color and saying, I have an agenda for how they want to organize themselves. My job is to be support and to step in. And this is another issue about climate issues. I see a lot of, right now, there's a lot of really stressed out climate scientists, and they are at their wits' end. How do they communicate? And they've taken on really harsh messages. The world is dying. Everything's doomed. And then you have to do something. They have no solutions. They just say, the data shows we are dying. And one thing I've noticed is a couple different NASA scientists and people in other positions of knowledge, they're knowledgeable people, they do their first climate action. They chain themselves to a building. They do something radical. And they notice that it's really hard and not a lot of people participate. And then they complain, I did this. I'm the only one doing this. I've seen a lot of climate messaging around the notion of we should be responding to climate change as if it was a world war with that kind of agenda.
That was even a column, I think, that came out last week
somewhere. I know, and I was invited to work at an organization that was focused on a wartime vision for climate response. And I asked them two questions. The first was, if you're modeling your movement after wartime response, what is your anti-imperialist plan? How are you avoiding imperialism in your wartime response as you're reimagining the world? And then the second was, why are you envisioning a LARPing made-up war when indigenous communities have been involved in 500 years of struggle holding the line on climate change? We know that 80% of the Earth's biodiversity is currently held by native people on indigenous landscapes under indigenous management. That means that the mass extinction has already occurred under white and colonized landscapes. So if you view your project as anything other than lending support to existing movements, you're kind of creating this like pat yourself on the shoulder, I tried but nobody came thing. There are existing movements that you can step in and support. That doesn't mean you can't start your own project, you know, but think about it in terms of solidarity and being part of a network of people and understanding that your job there is to, God, give any kind of relief to the existing movements that are holding the line on climate.
If you just tuned in, we're keeping it real. I'm Lisa Loving. This is KBOO Community Radio. Our guest is Jordan Fink of Build Soil. I love this conversation. These are deep conceptual waters because you know, in some way, when I start using the word capitalism, even I stop listening, right? Like, what does that even mean? It's almost like a baseball bat. But it goes down to my old friend who would always bring up, like, somebody somewhere, if somebody can't make money from it, you're not going to get the institution to support it. And this conversation, when we're talking about the people we love, the young people around us and the old people and the people that are our age who feel hopeless, like the suicide rate is insane in this country.
And I get contacted by a lot of young people who are considering it.
Right.
As they face climate change.
Oh my God! Well, thank you for taking on that heavy burden because again, it's almost like that perspective. Like you said, people, it's the invisible hand of the market that's going to make it right. So if there is no invisible hand, that means nothing can make it right. That's part of that whole analysis, and it's hard. It's almost impossible not to fall into that pit.
Inevitability that they're trying to create for us,
right? And that's real. And you know, it's like watching a Star Wars movie, and you're coming out of warp drive and you're coming right into a battle between a planet and a bunch of ships, and the ships are moving really slowly, but you know they're going to crash. You know what I'm saying?
So I want to say something really quick about paralysis.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking
about.
You're
talking about the blending of activism and science and how those things come together. So there's a counterintuitive idea from thermodynamics, right? Which is asking the question of how does work happen? You have an amount of energy, you need a thing to happen. Well, if you try to get the most efficient out of that, if you try to get 100% out of 100% in nature, it doesn't work. Things halt. If you are 0% efficiency, things halt. And this is the reason why you might have a million blades of grass to 1,000 deer to a single wolf. There are inefficiencies built into the flow of energy. And it turns out that in thermodynamic systems, you actually have to be at 50% efficiency in order to have maximum power. The most energy flow happens at 50% efficiency. And I've been discovering more and more that as we wait for the perfect solution to, you know, making changes, as we try to exert the most efficient action, we are actually creating, and there's a lot of market pressures and a lot of societal pressure to be the most efficient as possible. We're actually halting ourselves. Being less efficient actually allows you more flow and movement. And here's the thing, since natural systems optimize at 50% efficiency, any system that claims to be efficient more than that is extracting from somewhere else.
My brain just went...
Any system that's claiming to be powerful and efficient is actually exploiting labor, exploiting ecologies, exploiting energies created and stored by other people, other communities, and other systems.
I just need some silence behind that. This is one of the most thoughtful interviews I've ever had with anyone. And we've had some amazing people on this show, even though the show is pretty young right now.
So I really encourage people to be consistent, but far less efficient than they've been trying to be.
A little, maybe a little more efficient than just throwing the seeds on the ground. I love that guy so much. He ended up becoming like a small plane pilot. It's pretty interesting.
But so, I really do encourage people just to do something and find their flow.
So now... let's shift into your project that you're doing this fall.
That's right. So we did already give away about 15,000 trees in the Pacific Northwest over the last few years, and we have 500, 600 left right now. These trees in particular were partially paid for by a grant from the East Multnomah County Soil and Water Conservation District.
Woo-hoo!
They're amazing. They've been cheering us on for the last few years. And that means these trees, most of them need to go into East Multnomah County just to support that.
County needs more trees.
Yeah, and we'll be planting about 10,000 more over the next year or two. So seasons change from year to year, and our trees need to go out while they're dormant. That's usually November and December. So we have on buildsoil.net, we have a survey right at the beginning, which basically you can communicate your interest. You can say how many trees you want. You can tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll get in touch with you when the trees are ready to be picked up and planted. You need at least 2 chestnut trees, and optimal distance is somewhere between 20 feet and 60 feet. That might be prohibitive for some yards, but hey, you can bring in your neighbors. And you can also see if there's already existing chestnut trees in your neighborhood that would co-pollinate with your yard. Now, those trees should be 10 feet from a foundation.
Of the house. Of the building.
And we are one of the few cities in the country that has fast-tracked and supported the planting of chestnut trees in parking strips. However, they need to be 6 feet wide or greater for Portland to allow them, just to make sure that they don't, you know, break up the sidewalks. And the city asks for a check-in and a permit process. But you can plant them in yards, you can plant them elsewhere without that process. We are very lucky that some activists in the 90s decided that chestnut trees were important for our community.
Are you kidding me right now? In the 90s?
In the 90s. And they worked through helping the city make sure that it had made a good decision.
With that approval. I want to know who did that. And I'm not saying that you have to pull up your phone
right
now.
I'm actually planning on doing some interviews with those folks sometime soon. So.
I'm going to stick my neck out and say, Jordan Fink, you should actually have a show about this Waves and in a few minutes we'll talk about how people can get a show on KABU.
Oh, great!
But are you going to also be doing tree mapping with people? Like, what are all the things? So people are listening right now.
Yeah,
in the next 6 months, people are going to kind of wake up and think, "I need to do something."
Yeah. So right now, this fall, we're giving away these trees. We will probably go on hiatus over the winter for that. And then if we have trees left, we'll be doing a final handoff in the spring as well. So if you're not ready, there might be time later. And then we'll be doing more planting in that next spring for the next year. And I'm still trying to figure out how many I want to plant for, you know, how much interest there is. But we're doing a couple other things. So we are working on a mapping system right now, which will allow people to see existing trees if they want. Then make ongoing scientific and community observations about those trees. we are trying to fact check and confirm to make sure that the trees that people are mapping are actually chestnuts and not poisonous horse chestnuts. Beautiful trees, great for bees and pollinators, not good for eating. And we will have resources soon on our website for training yourself to tell the difference. It's very easy once you learn, but you need to learn. I've met a lot of people who are like, oh, chestnuts make me sick. And I'm like, show me the tree. And it's always a horse chestnut. And so at the same time, we are going to be doing more. I have been doing some streaming on Twitch, teaching about ecological design. We have a Discord group, which you can sign up for on our website, buildsoil.net. And we also are beginning to have a newsletter, which will be steered at the right time of the year. So you'll get a newsletter that says, okay, we're about to enter into this period. This is how you should be interacting with chestnuts. Here's some recipes. Here's some options.
This is how you should be interacting with chestnuts.
because we imagine that in the future, Portland will have millions of these trees within our region and people will be able to eat. And there'll be Castana Festas and there'll be community events and there'll be co-ops that do milling and processing of nuts. We have some really beautiful sister projects that are working with Mesquite and do community pancake breakfasts and milling together to make flour. So flour is really the year-round benefit of chestnuts.
Cracking me up because I know so many people that actually we get to a certain age and our body starts to reject our mass-produced flour that we have in our culture. So don't let me talk French on these airwaves now because that gets confusing. But I want to walk it back just the tiniest bit. So people who are listening right now and all their family and friends and maybe the young people in their lives and their neighbors, everybody wants to do something. So what kind of volunteers would really thrive with the work that you're putting on the table?
Oh, interesting. Well, we're encouraging people to start their own projects and trying to support that work globally. But it's also totally possible to get involved. And you can go to our website and send us an email, send us a message if you want to get involved. Right now, it's very small because we're coming out of extreme quarantine with people. And we work with immunocompromised people, so we're very cautious still about COVID. But there are opportunities right now for just helping us set up our backyard nursery and making it a little bit better of a space.
People that like plants, people that like working outside, people that like working with plants, but they don't have to know all the things.
No. And actually, we encourage chestnut planting in the spring in raised beds about 2-3 inches apart. Raise them like they're, beans or something, and then handing them out after a year or two. They do best in the shade. So actually, if you have a weird little shady spot that you can put a tiny raised bed, you're already prepared to plant trees for that year. And we're trying to make those kinds of things available to people. But at the same time, I would just go a little bit wider and say, we need groups coming together and looking at projects. It doesn't have to be gardening, though that's fun and helpful, and you learn a ton. Like, if you want to talk about water policy, learn how to manage water in your yard. If you want to understand plants and plant ecology and climate change, let's start mapping the seasons and understanding your environment. It's actually worth it to do those small little things as training, and so that we can scale up. It would be hubris to think that we can make giant changes without having
personal connections.
And the other thing is, no matter what you do, I think it's really important that you have a small group of friends that work together, trust each other, know each other's limits, know each other's safety issues, have learned to talk through your conflicts. Those types of things, we can't have big spokes councils and large scale cooperative endeavors unless people have learned how to do it, and you learn it through actual actions. So, I'm not trying to be trite here. I think this is the most essential thing, is to get started somewhere. Start at your doorstep. And then we have collective power of people who have learned how to do those basic things together.
I love the thought that the first thing that we need to do is learn how to get along with each other. Oh, and beyond God. That, yeah.
I mean, back when I worked with City Repair, the first thing that every neighborhood group that we helped facilitate, the first thing they learned is that they didn't know how to talk. They often had conflicts that they discovered were not actually conflicts, but were about semantics or about they wanted the same larger goals, but they had different ideas about how to get there. And if we didn't do the massaging of good facilitation, we were trained by Quakers, like learning good consensus process, we were never able to get to that higher level of understanding, and because they were stuck on the details.
I still have like 10 questions to ask you. We've got 3 minutes left.
Be happy
of the
to come
show.
Back some other time.
I think you should, and I think you should have your own show. What's the most important thing for KBOO listeners to know about Build Soil?
we're small, but we're trying to make something that is meaningful and supportive for people. We believe that it is like human beings are actually capable of supporting their own foundations, of taking care of the planet, of building capacity. We can make our cities and communities places that are vital and able so that we can take and relieve landscapes that need to be returned to indigenous people. We have the ability to take responsibility for our actions and the unfortunate legacies that we've inherited. We have the ability to do a lot in terms of that. Climate change can be slowed by human activity, just as it's being accelerated by human activity, but it actually will take doing things. Hope is only as good as the way that it connects you with the possibility of action. We also have to be willing to make a ton of mistakes and try a lot of different things as we do it.
And not stress out about efficiency so much.
No, don't be. Stop being so efficient. It's really killing a generation right now of people waiting to be perfect.
In multiple ways. That's it for our show.
It's lovely to be here.
We've been keeping it real. I'm Lisa Loving. Jordan, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for KABU for being here my entire life. This has been an important place for me.
Hey, and if in case you didn't know, that there is a KABU block party. It's the 55th anniversary. It's the 55th birthday party this Saturday right outside the station. Definitely show up. I'm going to be here. Find out more about Jordan's work at buildsoil.net. Special thanks to KABU Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne. Get involved in KABU Community Radio by emailing volunteer@kabu.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.